Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. I'm excited about this one. I've wanted to do this one for a while because, straight up, Nick Hippa is an old friend of mine. I have known him since 2007 or 8 or 9, sometime around then. And I've always known him to be one of the coolest, most genuine, awesome people in the game. He's also a really, really killer guitar player, great person. A little bit of history about him. Nick is a guitar player and songwriter who gained popularity for his time in As I Lay Dying between 2004 and 2021. He's also been a part of projects such as Woven War and, of course, his current project, Mire. Most recently, you may have seen that he's playing guitar for the God Forbid reunion shows, and he's made various appearances on all kinds of albums. Anyhow, I welcome Nick Hippa. Awesome. Well, Nick Hippa, welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast.
Thank you, dude. It's an honor to be here.
It's a pleasure. It's an honor to have you here as well. I'm glad to be doing this. I'm glad we finally lined up the schedules because life's been busy lately.
Dude, yeah. I mean, I think we initially talked about doing this like several months ago, but yeah just got a bunch going on. So stoked that we're able to lock it down.
How are the God Forbid shows going?
Well, I've done three with them. You know, the first one I did was Blue Ridge Rock Festival in September. And then I just got home last week from doing a Jersey show, which is like a hometown show at a Starland Ballroom in Sayreville.
Those pictures looked great.
Yeah, dude, it was awesome. I think my favorite shows were those shows in Jersey and Mass. You know, they're at venues that have been legendary in the lives of people in our like scene, you know, the Starland Ballroom and the Palladium. All of our bands have history in those places. So to go there and have people be like super enthusiastic and stoked, it was a lot of fun.
Do you have a process for learning other people's music and getting comfortable with it? I've never had to learn like somebody else's set. And normally the music that I've played on stage has been music I've written for the most part. Well, I did it once for a black metal band, but I don't have too much experience learning a bunch of songs by somebody else and then going and doing it. So I'm wondering how that is for you.
Yeah. You know, I think that learning people's songs, it's something that at this point comes naturally in a way, because that's how I've just always progressed at guitar, is by learning things by ear, just trying to figure things out. And I feel like that process for me was the most fun way to practice and grow. So in learning these God Forbid tunes, I did the same thing. I would just learn as much as I could by ear, and Doc tabbed out the entire set, you know, which I really appreciate. There's a part of me that's just like, no, I'm not going to look at tabs because it's going to take away from, you know, the mind hand connection and all of that. But I did appreciate that. And it was cool to look at what I thought it was, or to look at what it actually was versus what I thought it was and what I was playing. And sometimes it would be just a difference in position, same note, same feel, but like the position was different. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, I didn't, had that wrong. So the process for me with learning people's songs for the purpose of playing them, I would try and do a song a day, learning by ear, running through it several times that day, and then the next day immediately first thing go back and play it and lock it in, and then that's like song one is in the queue. And then I would repeat that process while the day of repetition would also include the song that was done before it. So by the time I got to song like 12, I'd be playing 11 songs after I played that song 12 that I had recently learned the day before. And then once they were all there, then it's just daily practice. Like for me, it's repetition, because they're not like my songs or, you know, from my band, and I wasn't involved in the process, which, you know, when you go on tour or when you're playing shows for your band and it's songs that you wrote and were involved for every step of the way, like it just, you have that muscle memory and that.
It's a part of you.
Yeah, it's a part of you, so you can recall it. But for somebody else's set, I'm not thinking the same way they are. So it's constant reps, you know, like every single day. And I would make that like an absolute when I was, you know, mapping out my, you know, every morning I wake up and I kind of map out my schedule. It's just like, this is a non-negotiable. For this 2 hours, I'm running through the God Forbid set twice, you know. No way I'm steering from that. That's how I did it. And then further jamming with Doc and Corey, and just kind of getting some guidance from him about like things that I was playing accurately, but not correctly. And as far as feel,
that's a good distinction right there, actually.
Yeah, it was really cool, because that's something that I find really interesting and fun about learning other people's stuff, is you get insight into a different creative mind and a different creative approach. And then it becomes something that you can put in your bag of tricks, you know. But there was some songs where, you know, Doc was, he was like, dude, you're playing that accurately, but you got to like jersey it up a bit. And I was just like, what do you mean jersey it up?
I call it right, but wrong.
Yeah.
Because it's right, but it's not. I guess what it comes down to, the fact that, or the idea that music is more than just the notes. You need both, right? You need the feel and the notes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're a lot of guitar players, we're all learning, but I mean, like in the intermediate stages and still figuring everything out stages, I think where a lot of guitar students mess themselves up is by focusing either only on the notes or only on the feel, not this marriage between the two. And I think you need both. It's not really music without both.
Dude, absolutely. And I think that when you're starting out and you're just looking at tabs, you know, I know I was extremely guilty of this when I was a kid. I would look at tabs and just play the notes as I saw them on the sheet and be like, well, I'm playing everything. Like, I know how to play fade to black perfectly because these are all the notes, but your rhythm is all off.
Mm-hmm.
Your palm muting is all sloppy. It doesn't sound like the way it's supposed to sound. And I think it's not till you get older and you start recording and hearing yourself play it back and you're like, this isn't necessarily lining up. And that's when you focus on the most important thing, which is sounding good.
Yeah, totally. The right notes, but wrong position. You know, I think live, that might be a little less important because at the end of the day, you kind of need to just be able to play it. But for a recording, that makes a massive difference, like a massive difference in how the riff is going to come across. Like, for instance, like Mastodon, they do a lot of riffs. I guess it depends how you think of horizontal or vertical across the neck. I think of it as vertical, as in from 0 to the 12th fret. So like all the way up and down a string, they do a lot of riffs that are like on one string, or they'll hit the same amount of notes as a band that's, you know, playing in one position, but they do it vertically and they sound very unique. The only way to get those riffs to sound that way is to play them like that. There might be easier ways to play them, more, I guess, economical ways to play them. And I know lots of shredders who would be like, what the fuck are you doing? And I can play this with minimal movement and expend zero energy. I am an efficient terminator, but it just won't sound or feel the same way. It won't feel right. Super important stuff.
Yeah, dude, I totally agree. I mean, the tone is going to be different, you know, on a 56 gauge low string, you know, versus you playing the same thing like on, you know, the fifth or the fourth string even. I don't know. I feel like where you fret it and the gauge and just like the position on the neck adds to the magic.
How you play into the notes, how you play out of the notes, like the space between the notes. It's just, it all matters.
Yeah, totally. And I think when you've got the ability to record yourself and really like mess around and explore that, you hear that and you realize how important it is. You know, I had learned early on just from working with like producers or like, you know, musicians who are just like, oh, I see that you're trying to make this more economical or efficient with the position that you're playing in, but it loses some of the magic.
Yeah. One thing I noticed when doing two guitar harmonies is that, like, say you're harmonizing in thirds or something, which is like just a standard thing in metal, is left and right harmonies and thirds in a riff. It's just normal stuff that everybody does pretty much. And it's like the initial instinct that, like, say that the, say, you know, in standard tuning, like if you're doing a minor third harmony of like the third fret, that you would do the first fret on the next string up, you know, on the other guitar. But like the difference in tone between those two strings on a recording is like one will sound thick and the other will sound a lot thinner. If you do it at the sixth fret on the other guitar instead, it'll have the same tone as the other side and will sound like much more of like one cohesive sound. And I think those little details make a huge difference. But live, I think it makes less of a difference. It's just because there's not that much detail live. Like, you just can't hear it.
Yeah. And I think when you're playing live, it's whatever. I don't want to say close enough because that sounds like it's, you're not seeking perfection. But when you're recording, it's whatever serves the recording and the sound. But live, it's what is the most feasible to play accurately and correctly and sound good. I know. I think that's where efficiency in playing is more important.
Yes. Well, there's more factors. Like, you're moving, you have an audience, you have your band members, you're like trying to not get hit by someone's headstock. Like there's all kinds of stuff going on. You're playing standing up in like some like weird position. I know that most people don't practice in like metal stance. Like it's, there's just all kinds of other factors going on that make for a less than ideal playing environment. And I think you need to take that into consideration when playing live.
Yeah, 100% agree.
I mean, even like where you hold your guitar, for me, holding it in dork position is like the easiest, but I don't want to do that on stage.
Yeah, you want to be in, like Wes Hout calls it regs, like regulate. It's like, it's almost like if you're looking at basketball, like the strike zone, you know, it's a little bit higher, but it's like, you gotta be there. You can't be up all the way up here, you know, where your elbow is bent like up to your face. I mean, unless you're playing some extremely like crazy music that doesn't really matter if you're rocking out or not. But
like if you play bass in a country band or something, they tend to hold it really high.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah.
For hard rock and metal guitar playing, like you think of the Hetfields, you know, just freaking all the way at the bottom of regs and just like crushing it, looking sick.
It's awesome. Imagine if Zakk Wylde held his guitar like Tom Morello.
Dude, you know what? It's like with a guy like Zakk, and I realized this, and I started to cop it in like 2010-ish, but he keeps it down for riffing, so he looks sick, and he gets all the good photos, you know, for the magazines. But then when it comes time for the shreddies, he's a foot up. He almost like puts his guitar up, but then it's cool because it's like a move, you know? So it's like, oh, look at me just putting my guitar on my thigh that's on the monitor and like ripping a crazy scorching solo. But it's not cheating, but it definitely makes it a lot easier to play those things, you know? So, I mean, I think he's the template for looking sick and also doing what you need to do to play the parts correctly when it's time.
Absolutely. Yeah. He mounts it into classical position when he does that. And I asked him if it's deliberate and he said yes. So there's no accident to that. It's so that he can play that stuff.
Dude, I completely forgot that you guys like did a course with him and that you had access to his mind. So confirmed. It's not just like
confirmed.
Whoa, what a pro.
Well, I was always curious about it because it was like, well, yes, it looks really cool, but getting that kind of ferocity that he gets.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you seen some of those live videos from like 2000 or something like those years where it's just like the most savage player you can possibly imagine playing super fast, but like not playing lightly, just playing hard, so ferocious. That guitar position really, it makes it possible.
Dude, yeah, I used to watch like every video I could of him. And then, you know, I was able to play festivals with him over the years or like do a Black Label tour once. And I'd always be lurking and watching him play. And his attack is so wide, even in areas where you think it should be more like precise with minimal movement, like say on some runs down the neck, he's like really wide, like just ferocious attack, but he's only hitting the notes that he wants to hit, but with so much power and steez.
Steez, that's a good word.
Yeah, dude, it's a great word to describe just his sound, because when you hit it with that much energy, it's like every single note is screaming at you, you know? That's awesome. Man, that's so cool that you got to really like get under the hood there with his playing and approach.
It was a very fascinating thing to do. I mean, you know, from being around him, he's a super cool human and it's always a good vibe. So that was cool in and of itself. And then it was also surreal, obviously, because, you know, like we did the No More Tears. I mean, we did the song, but like did the solo, like hearing him basically go through it 30 times right in front of me. It's surreal, basically. But the thing that I found really fascinating outside of like the guitar side of it was that when he would start playing, every single person in the room would basically just get hypnotized. And the crew that we had, they're not like Zakk Wylde fanboys or anything. Some of them had never even heard of him before. Some of us had, of course. But some people were not metal people. They were just like some local crew that we hired to like add numbers of cameras and operators. He has this thing where, the moment he starts playing, even starts talking, but just starts playing, It's like nothing else exists in the room, whether you're a guitar fan or not, or have heard of him or not. And I thought that that was interesting, that level of charisma. I don't know where it comes from, because I've only met a few people ever who have that sort of thing. You know, when you see people arguing about who should get what gig or what, the thing they don't understand is how real and powerful that level of charisma is and how rare. There's a reason for why he's doing the Pantera thing outside of the friendship with them, which is like, who else has big enough of a presence to do that? I can't think of anybody who could both play it, has the relationship with everybody, but then also has enough of a presence to be on that stage and not like, not be kind of like a joke, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's a weird thing.
You still hear it nowadays, but guys from the old school, like Zach, just him specifically, like his sonic identity is to me very unique and almost magical in a way that I was the same way when I toured with him like 7 years ago. Whenever he would plug into his amp, or say his guitar tech would be playing his tone through his amp, and you're like, oh, that sounds, that's a killer tone, you know? But then he somewhere along the way picks up the guitar, and you're in another room, but then you hear him just play a chord and you're like, oh dude, Zach's got the guitar now. And then, yeah, I would come out and I would watch it, and there's just this spirit hand like performance connection that when you hear it, it sounds like magical and special to that player. And I think that's what I've always loved and found fascinating about guitars, is how in the hands of the right individual, it can sound like something that like that you can't not pay attention to, you know? And I think that comes from a lifetime of devotion and obsession to the craft.
Yeah, he's definitely still obsessed. And if you notice, those dudes that have that thing, no matter what age they are, like their obsession stays constant.
Yeah, and I think maybe sometimes like the things that they get obsessed with like change.
Well, yeah, of course.
That's really like the secret though, isn't it? It's just a deep love and pursuit of your craft.
I think that that's like pretty much it. The thing that I've noticed with like the best players, the most inspiring and best players, is that they're still going after it the same way they always have. And regardless of what's going on in their life, like obviously as you get older, it gets harder to just play 12 hours a day, every single day, and like forget about everything else, but they still figure it out and they're still driven to keep upping their game. And they still watch other guitar players and get wowed or get intimidated or whatever range of emotions would happen. They tend to not get over that, like that desire to keep on improving.
Yeah. On the topic of good guitar players being wowed or intimidated by people, I saw like a Van Halen show at the Forum. It was like a friends and family. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't like a full on show, but it was still at the Forum.
And it was Van Halen?
It was Van Halen, yeah. But okay. It was almost like a live dress rehearsal that they invited like just all sorts of people to, but it wasn't on sale to like the public or whatever. But I remember just a who's who of famous or like renowned guitar players standing in front of stage left and all just like taking notes, you know? Like, I mean, whether it was like guys like Tom Morello, or it was just a lot of different guys. I think Jerry Cantrell, like just a top tier dude, just kind of like staying in awe of Eddie's playing, or just like studying him and just listening to his tone. I thought that was really special, in that like no matter what stage you are in your guitar playing journey, like you always like admire like somebody just doing something really like sick and just being great at the same thing that you do. And maybe that it's intimidating or it's like defeating in a way, but it's just something that you're always going to hold in high regard, I guess.
Totally. And the intimidating thing, in my opinion, it's like a positive kind of intimidation.
Yeah.
I don't see that as a negative thing. It's like intimidating because, wow, I can't do that, or I can't imagine ever being able to do that, or how is this real? But then ultimately, it should be inspiring, I think.
Yeah.
What are you obsessed by these days?
Man, I think just writing music, just trying to come up with stuff that makes the dudes in my band excited, you know, with Meyer. I just get really pumped on working with these guys to just put out music that we're happy with and fulfilled by. So on like a personal level, just like creating music with the homies.
Yeah, that's a good one. So do you write on your own or do you write together, first of all?
We're writing on our own. And a lot of times, like, we're sending ideas back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it'll even be something like Ryan, our other guitar player, will send a full song that requires like almost no tweaking. And it'll just be like, you know, this one little riff or this one little section, like, let's laser focus on here. And let's all just kind of like figure out how to make this what we need it to be for the song to be complete. And then that, even though that's not as collaborative as sitting in a room with each other, I think just taking a mostly full idea and making the song in general represent something that you guys all love, like, that's fun to me. Or even vocal ideas, like having a melody and being bold enough to present it to your friends with some lyrical ideas. I think just making yourself vulnerable in the creative process and having people that you respect for their talent and proficiency be like, oh, that's cool to me too. It's like validation in a way that you're like, oh, sick, I do, you know, we've all got cool ideas and we're all bringing it to life together. Because of logistics and where we're at, we're not able to do things in a room, you know, so it is the Pro Tools and Dropbox method. But you know, that has its advantages and ways that jamming in a room doesn't. But I do come from the jamming in the room era as well. So I think just there's different ways to enjoy creativity and creation. And if you can tap into at least one of them, like, you're sitting pretty.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the Dropbox collaboration method. Lots of great stuff gets done that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the more convenient use of time. You know, if somebody has
absolutely
one riff and then you have another and then you can send stems back and forth or finish up a bridge that, you know, that the song didn't have and send it. You know, it's practical, I think, for the way things are now.
What's the process when it comes to making changes? So, like, say you start a song, are you writing the whole thing and sending it to them, or is it like a verse and a chorus? And how far does it need to get before you're like, I'm sending this over?
Dude, it can be anything. It can be like, I mean, dude, we've sent voice memos to each other, like, mm-hmm. you know, just like, dun, 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 get, like, you're just like, like that, like, what do you guys think? Or like whisper screams or something. But I think it depends on how comfortable you are with your bandmates and how well you understand their ability to see through like a less than polished presentation. There's some, mm-hmm. there's some things that if you send, like, if you're like, if somebody is asking for like a collaboration or like maybe even a guest spot, then I'll just try and make it as dialed and you know, as well performed as possible. So there's minimal changes, because I feel like if you don't, then they're like, oh, this isn't that sick, because they don't see like the end, you know?
Yeah, it's a big ask to like expect them to understand what's in your head.
Yeah. And so in our situation, like, we don't even have to give the paragraph to paragraph long demo disclaimer when you're like, so, you know, I just like, I did this at 1 o'clock at night, like, it's out of tune and out of time, but like, you know, that whole thing, you're just like,
it's going to be cool. Trust me.
Yeah. So it can be anything. It can be a full song idea, or it can be, here's up to a chorus, or here's just a voice memo. But I think just staying super open and moving with the creative process is what we're focused on.
It's interesting. Like, I know that I punish my bandmates sometimes when I get on a roll with like improving something we're working on. I'll start rapid firing. Yeah, sometimes they'll get lots of clips like in a very short period of time, 20 or something. And then I feel like a total weirdo. But I get excited about it and I want to share it, because once I think it's sick, it's important for me that I'm not being delusional, I guess, or that everybody thinks it's sick so I can keep going. Cause I have no interest in like finishing songs that people are kind of on the fence about. Now, if they're on the fence about it because I haven't fleshed it out right, and I know that it's like 30% there and they're not really feeling it, but they don't know what I've got in store for it, mm-hmm. then that's one thing. But I refrain from sending those, just because I don't want to get bummed out by their reaction. So I wait till I think it's sick. It's a good rule of thumb for me.
Yeah, but I mean, I've heard some of your demos, and they're pretty well thought out and also very sick. So,
well, thank you. Well, just the ones I've let you hear.
Oh yeah. Because you waited until they were sick.
That's the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to send something that I'm on the fence about. When I go into writing periods, it'll be like all out for a stretch of time where it's like every single day, not necessarily all day, every single day, but it's like a lot of stuff happening. And the amount of ideas that I'm going through, like, they can't all be great. And so what I try to do is very quickly determine what's awesome and what's not, and just forget about the stuff that's not awesome. And if I'm working on something that I think is cool but is not awesome, then fuck it, on to the next thing. And just keep on going on to the next thing, on to the next thing, on to the next thing. Because I know that if I keep doing that, eventually something is going to happen that I think is sick. And then the other dudes are going to start getting rapid fire messages, basically.
Is there much wiggle room for changes on something that you think is sick, but somebody else is like, this could be sicker if you did this?
Yes, absolutely. I'm always hoping for that.
Yeah.
I have this philosophy that if something is not like 100%, you know that this part is like earth shattering and you know it's great. Like if a part is like, and this part's pretty cool, but not quite that next level, I'm down to completely scrap it.
Mm-hmm.
If we can totally delete it and just do something brand new, I would prefer that. Like, you know, those parts that just like, you're almost there with them. Like mm-hmm. They're like almost awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of those parts that I'm like, I'm hoping that Krim will like give me something I'm not seeing, for instance.
Dude, I think that's a great way to be. I think problems in the past that I've heard of or seen with bands is when people are so like precious over like a very specific part or an mm-hmm. idea and try and force it through. But the dudes who I've worked with who are really like talented and have like a lot of cool things out there, they are the like the opposite of precious about a part. They are just like constantly moving and trying to find the better idea or refine the rough idea. And I think when you're always in like the solution based mindset, you know, or the exploratory mindset, you can uncover something like way cooler than that one thing that you were just like trying to force to, you know, make happen.
Absolutely. I've noticed, and this is in my experience, the people that are the most precious about that stuff tend to write less.
Yeah.
They have low output in terms of writing. Therefore, every riff, everything they write is that much more important to them. So if they wrote four riffs for an album and you cut three of them, you just cut a whole lot of their output. Whereas if you write 100 riffs and you cut 75, you know, just 25 riffs is still a lot of riffs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of what I write gets cut, usually by me, before it ever gets anywhere. But I've had trouble with people who don't write much getting precious. And it's like, well, look, write more. Just write more.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. And one thing that's interesting is that some of those riffs that you were trying to force and that you couldn't make happen, like you might just keep in your personal riff bin, but maybe 5 years later, you're like, wait a second, this part that I have like mm-hmm. complements that riff. And then that riff gets new life, you know? So maybe it's just not, it's not that riff's time yet. It needs to incubate more in the ether.
Totally. On the Doth single that's about to come out that you heard, there's a riff on there on No Rest, No End. There's a riff from 1999 from like the very, very first demo. And that riff, it's in the solo section. And it's a riff that I just was always bummed that it didn't get a chance to do anything. And it stuck in my head this entire time. So like, I've definitely done that. And I definitely think that there are those riffs that they're valuable, but they're just not right for what you're working on. And I think that that's an important distinction. Like, yeah, it could be really cool, but if it's not cool in this context, just put it aside. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, save it. Throw it in the riff bin.
Yeah, you can always make something new. The reason I think people get precious too, there's a few reasons, but when they don't write very much, they're going to be more insecure about their writing and about their ability to just come up with something cool. I think that people who do it all the time and are in that exploratory solution-based mindset and who are doing it a lot, because they do it a lot, they know that they can come up with something else. So there's less like weird insecurity with it.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, I think consistency and getting reps.
Yeah.
It changes your relationship with creativity and writing. You know, there's always going to be something else that's going to come to you if you just keep at it.
That's a good way to put it, the getting reps. I like that.
Yeah. Maybe that comes from like sports or something. Maybe I hear that, like, just got to get reps in, you know, but,
yeah, but it's true.
Yeah. You're only increasing the odds of you coming up with something sick if you're making a habit out of constantly practicing and writing and doing it, you know.
Can we talk about Meyer and your journey as an independent artist some?
Absolutely, man.
Cool, because I think it's really cool, and I want to hear more about your take on that. Now that you've done it, you've done the independent thing, you've also done the pinnacle band on a big label thing, you've done a lower priority band on a big label. Like, you have a very wide range of experience now of like different ways that this whole thing could go. So I'm curious, is why did you decide to go indie this time around?
Yeah, it really did come from the curiosity and interest in just wanting to do it. You know, at this point in my life, I feel like I've dabbled extensively in like all parts of the music business, you know, whether it's like being in a band or like being a visual creator for bands or even like owning a venue and like putting on shows. And there's all like, I find that stuff fascinating because I love it and it's been part of my life and I've always wanted to know more. And I think that I've always been someone that likes learning by doing, if that makes any sense. It's like, oh, I'm just going to like, I want to understand it more, but I don't know that I will get as thorough of an understanding of this from books and conversations or YouTube videos as I would if I just did it, you know? And yeah. I did have some encouragement from friends who are independent artists. There's a synthwave band, Dance with the Dead. I think I talked to you about them before, but they're really good friends of mine. And I've done some stuff. I've like made visuals for them. I've recorded some stuff for them and I've like even tour managed them before. And they were just like, dude, you guys have this record and you have the ability to self-fund it. You should release it yourself because you would be surprised on just what that looks like on the back end, you know? And because I have experience in like rolling out records content wise, and also, you know, recording records from start to finish, I was like, yeah, what better time than now to do it? So it was more out of just interest and curiosity to see what it looks like when you know, how much work really goes into putting out a record. What are all the things that you need to, you know, what are all the ducks that you need to have in a row? Like, what are all the expenses? You know, what is all the money look on the other side of it with like your streams and, you know, your own sales, like handling all of that, because we even still fulfill all our own merch and getting all that stuff in line. But it's been a really informative and enlightening experience. And exciting in a way, because now we know. And so the next, you know, it's like, okay, here's all the information we got from this experience on top of the intrinsic reward of putting out something that's incredibly meaningful to us and cool, you know, aside from putting that out and generating like a, you know, a small, but like really cool fan base. It's like, man, now we can repeat the process and let's try and do better. And I mm-hmm. get a lot out of that in, I love going for it, doing it, assessing, and then trying to improve the next go around. And that's where we're at right now.
Do you like the admin side of it?
Not really, but I don't like doing it. I don't like spending my time doing stuff that I'm not thrilled on, you know, whether it's like, if it's like accounting or like an hour out of my day, like packaging stuff up and sending it to the post office. But I enjoy learning and understanding it and trying to think of ways to streamline it. I feel like we are acquiring new skills and new perception and new things that will allow us to do better and grow. And the more we improve, the more that we can focus on it more, you know, we can give it more of our time and our effort as it, like, as we refine the process and get smoother with it, you know, and it also becomes more viable financially.
Yeah. As you do better with it and have more experience, then next steps become easier. Like, if you do eventually get on a label, you have a way better understanding of how everything works. However, if you don't, but say you decide you want to hire an assistant or, you know, someone to help with certain aspects, it's way easier to explain it once you've done it than to just expect someone to understand how this works. So there's really no downside if you're the type of person who can actually stay organized enough to do it.
Yeah. And dude, that idea of outsourcing, I think that is something that once you have done it and you understand what it is and how much time it takes, you can be a lot more specific in who you outsource to and what you're looking for. And I feel like you can also get a better outcome from doing that. If you can do everything, that's great, but like you don't necessarily want to do everything, you know? So like we did the majority of this ourselves. Like we recorded with Otero. We had Jens mix it.
It's a great tag team.
Yeah. I'm never going to try and mix a metal record. You know what I mean? Like I'm terrible at it, but like, why not go to a pro, you know? And I think that's where the balance is. It's like, what are the things that you know that you can do well and that you can do exactly how you want versus the things that you might be able to do, but you would get a better outcome from and a better use of freeing up that time by having somebody who's going to just, you know, knock it out of the park and crush it. So that's what we learned. And that's what's been really fun about even talking about the next release, you know.
Do you think your experience on labels has helped you do a better job with this?
Yeah, I think, you know, my experience with labels has been really positive. I've been on some really sick labels, great people. And I've learned a lot about what they did that I thought was awesome. At the same time, I had always wondered with certain things, I'm like, man, I wonder what that takes or how you go about doing that. For my own peace of mind, I was like, really would like to just try this out just to see, see what it is. And in becoming an independent artist, I also have gotten a stronger appreciation for those labels because I'm like, man, respect, because they do this for a lot of bands and they do it in excellence, you know. So my friends that are considering going indie or going with a label, and I'm like, dude, try indie, like you'd be surprised. But if they go with a label, I'm like, you also made a good choice because you're in good hands there. Whatever direction they choose, I'm happy for them because it'll be a learning experience and it will be positive if they choose to look at all the positive things about that in respective avenue.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, well, first of all, being honest with yourself about what are you willing to do? What do you have the time to do? What's within your bandwidth? What are your priorities? What do you want out of it? Like all that stuff matters. Like if you're able to do everything required for the band musically, and then also do everything required to be an independent artist, that's cool. That's really, really cool, actually. If you are that type of person who is interested in it, why not try it? But also, like, it might be that you don't have the bandwidth for it, or you're not good at that sort of thing. You just don't have a brain for being organized or admin tasks. Like, it's not so much that you don't enjoy them, but you frankly suck at them. And it's a disaster if you try to do that. A lot of musicians are like that. They're phenomenal at art and their bands, but they're atrocious at business. If they were not on a label, they wouldn't be anywhere. And I think it's important to be honest with yourself about all those things because they all matter. Not every artist is the personality type to be indie, but then also not every artist is the personality type to work well with a label. Some artists are just not meant to do anything outsourced or barely anything outsourced. And it's important to like have honest conversations with yourself about that.
I agree. And I think that the most important takeaway from that is that honest self-assessment is one of the strongest qualities I think you can have as a creative, whether it relates to pursuing an independent endeavor and being able to say, I am good at this. I am good at this. I'm pretty shot at this. Like this is, you know, even being able to see that and accept that will help give you a better course of action for how you pursue that.
Yep.
Even with playing, you know, I think the guys that are able to listen to themselves or see like areas where growth can happen or where time needs to be spent, I think those are the dudes that end up being like sick or just constantly getting better. It's just like, man, like I'm pretty solid at this, but this is shot. Like I got to work on this. I got to spend some time here. I think if you're able to look at yourself and the things that you're doing with an honest mind and heart and not get butthurt about it, then you can develop and progress. Cause if you think everything is great, you're limited in a way.
Yeah. I think also though, like thinking back to like music school, one thing that was really, really pushed on me was sight reading. I got okay with it. Also, I had some prior experience with doing it on other instruments. So I wasn't coming in from zero, but they were pushing it at school to where you should be able to sight read like a classical musician to where, you know, you're in the orchestra pit at a production and you sit down and there's sight music and you just play that shit. If that's what you want to do for a living with guitar, then yes, you should definitely, absolutely be bad ass at sight reading. But if that's not what you want, if you don't want to do that with your guitar playing and you're also not very good at sight reading, yeah, it's good to honestly assess your level, but just because you're not good at it doesn't mean you need to work on it. So you also need to take into consideration what it is you want, because something like getting that good at sight reading takes a long time and a lot of work. Could those hours be better spent on something else? Like if you really see no future for yourself playing in an orchestra pit or as like a true session player, like can walk into literally any situation, if it's an orchestra recording a soundtrack or like some pop session or whatever, and just if that's not you, it's not most people, then maybe sight reading's not the best use of your time.
Yeah, I feel that. Dude, I went to a music school as well, but like did not do music.
What did you do?
Well, so I went to college at the University of North Texas, which is like, they've got a solid music program there for sure. And I only lived like 45 minutes away and I was just like, oh, sick. Like that's where I'm going to go to school because I want to be a sick musician, you know, but it was very much like, okay, are you going to be a jazz guitarist or a classical guitarist? And these are the requirements to even be able to hang here. You know, you have to be looking at charts and working on all this stuff for like 8 hours a day minimum. And I very quickly was just like, I just want to be in a band. I was able to understand very quickly that I didn't see a future for myself mm-hmm. in either of those directions, as much as I respected them and thought that, you know, I still think that anybody that is proficient in those things is like a real musician.
I know what you mean.
I ended up just doing English because I feel like if I'm nurturing my mind and my creativity in one way, like that'll always serve some sort of purpose in the context of just like being a dude in a band. But I agree with what you're saying, and like knowing what you're going for with your craft. You know, if you're wanting to be a session musician or playing an orchestra, then there's a path for that. But if you want to be in a sick band, then you should be, you know, working on your playing in the band setting and writing, you know, because those are sounding good, and writing cool stuff is the necessary, you know, ingredients for being a musician in our world. And so that's where you should be spending your time.
Yeah. And it's hard, like that in and of itself, you know, you can spend your whole lifetime on that, on just that. So I remember Wes said this actually in a Q&A, that even if you were to live your entire natural lifespan and you get like, you know, a good run out of it, like you make it to like 89 or something, even then you're not going to be able to cover everything there is to cover on guitar. Say you get your full natural lifespan of working hard at it, you're still not going to cover it all. You just can't. There's too much. So you need to be selective.
Pretty profound.
And that's Wes.
Yeah. who ironically enough, in my opinion, seems to be freaking sick at everything.
He doesn't think so.
That again goes to that like self-assessment where he knows all the holes in his game. And I'm like, look, man, I'm not seeing it, like, you know, but that is true. And I do feel like, as you know, the older you get, the more you're able to, and hopefully it doesn't take a lot of age to become this way, but you're able to see like what's important and what is not with everything you want to do in life and everything you want to do in music, and just like laser focus on those things that are important to you.
So what's important to you now?
I just want to craft and release powerful tunes with my friends and just keep on doing that, because I think my definition of what's like powerful or what's good, it's always changing as new influence and new art and music and all these things come into my, you know, come in and out of all of us. You know, we listen to new things and get inspired by new things. You want to put it through the filter of yourself and your bandmates and put out whatever that end result is. It's like, hey, this is, and this is kind of the way I feel about everything in my past. It's like, man, when I was 21, this is the best that I had, and this is the best that we all had, and this is the result. And if I look back on my life, it's like time stamped in a way by mm-hmm. records and art, and even like with video stuff, I'm like, oh, there's all these cool things that I was able to be a part of or create. And that's what, aside from, you know, just like family and relationships and all that. Like, that's what really matters to me the most, is just staying in a creative state and just putting stuff out, so that when it's, you know, if I do have a natural life, you know, hopefully, or natural lifespan, that at the end of it, it's like, cool, my whole life is kind of documented in one way through like art. And you can, you can hear that, you know, that Nick Hippa at 40 was like radically different than this dude at, you know, 27, and so on and so on, you know, and just like always be creating, man.
Is it interesting to realize that you want different things now than maybe you did when you were 25 or 21?
No, I think that's just the way it goes. You know,
I think it is the way it goes to want different things, but to realize and accept that you want different things, I think is not necessarily the way it goes. I think sometimes people have to do some personal inventory to like get to the point where they're like, oh yeah, I'm 40 or something. I'm 30. I'm not 20. Obviously I want different things than I did 10 or 20 years ago. Like, wouldn't that be weird if I wanted the exact same things? And then to have that realization, I think, is super healthy, super positive, but I don't think it's entirely natural.
Yeah. I think health, like mental and physical health, comes from consistent checking of it. Well, you said checking inventory. I don't know how you put it, but like,
yeah, just taking inventory or checking in or whatever, going to a shrink, like anything.
Yeah. I mean, honest self-assessment. I feel like I've said it a couple times, but you know, at my age now, I'm like, what is important to me? What are the things I love and what are things that matter? And like really get to the core of those things. And yeah, if you're able to talk to someone to help you unpack those, that's great. If you're able to do it on your own, that's great. But I think that for me, the dream changed, you know, and I imagine that in 10 years, my definition of the dream, or like what matters to me, might change as well. And as long as I'm very honest about what those things are, and like honest in my pursuit of those things, then I'll like continue to live a happy life, you know? And that's really what it's all about at the end of the day.
Totally. Well, I think that's a perfect place to end this episode. I want to thank you very much for taking the time. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Dude, thank you so much for having me. Can't wait for all the new Doth to get released.
Thank you.
I don't think there's anyone out there more excited than me. So yeah, thank you, dude. It's great talking to you, as always.